You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is part one of seven in that series for 2009. Rick Britton introduces today's guest speaker.
We're here to listen to a good buddy of mine, Mark Leibson. He's been a journalist for a number of years. Listen to the publications he's written for: Smithsonian, Preservation, Washington Post, New York Times Book Review, Military History. We were just chatting back there a little bit earlier, and the one thing I admire about this guy, and he's written a number of books, he's got a bunch back here for sale, so please check him out, is Mark really knows, having been a journalist for a long time, he really knows how to tell a good story. And as you know, and the reason you're here, history is full of really, really good stories. He's a contributor to the Encyclopedia Americana, Dictionary of Virginia Biography, former staff writer for Congressional Quarterly, and you might have seen him on TV, on the Today Show, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, All Things Considered, that's the radio, Morning Edition. He's written a number of books, as I mentioned, in particular. He's going to be talking to us tonight about this recent one. And Mark, is this your most recent now? It still is, right? But you're working on another one probably, right? Okay, probably. He's going to tell us a little bit later. But an earlier one I'm very, very fond of, and you should check it out. He brought it back. This is a great one, too. It's Saving Monticello, and it focuses on all the different hands that Monticello passed through between Jefferson's death in 1826 and then the purchase by the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation in 1923. And, of course, he focuses the most on the Levy family, Jewish family from New York. And as a nation, we owe a huge debt of gratitude to that family for saving Monticello. And we owe this gentleman a debt of gratitude for telling such great stories. Please join me in welcoming my friend, Mark Leibson.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Rick, for that really good introduction, and thank you for reading it the way I wrote it. I guess I don't have to tell you that Rick is a really great guy, and I actually ran into him when I was doing the research for the Monticello book at the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, and we kept in touch, and then when the book came out, there was a really great review. Well, I got pretty good reviews, and they had newspapers back then when the book came out in 2002. But Rick wrote a great one in the Washington Times, and he's been a supporter of my work, and I really appreciate everything he's done for me. And thank you very much for coming out tonight. I am going to do a talk on this book. It is my latest book. It came out in 2007, and it's my sixth book, but it's my first book on Civil War, and I do not pretend to be an expert on the Civil War. Rick didn't mention it, but I do teach one class in U.S. history at Community College up in Northern Virginia where I live. And I teach the Civil War, too, but I knew the basics, but then when I got this book and I did the research, I really do consider myself an expert on a particular part of the Civil War. So I would encourage you to ask questions afterward, but since I'm not a Civil War expert, I'd like you to keep the questions within a certain framework. And that framework is, I will answer any questions about anything that happened in the Civil War between June 13th, 1864, and July 13th, 1864. Let me just qualify that. In the Eastern Theater and north of Richmond, okay? So I'll take any questions at all. June 13th, 1864. So where are we in the Civil War? This is the end of the bloodiest 6 weeks of the Civil War, the Wilderness Campaign, also known as the Overland Campaign, starting in late May. We had the last three big battles of the Civil War, and I think you know all of them. The Battle of the Wilderness out in Orange County, the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse, Grant's coming closer, and then the final big battle of the war, the Battle of Cold Harbor outside of Richmond. You know, even Grant, who was relentless, rested after Cold Harbor because in those previous 6 weeks, he suffered about 50,000 casualties, killed and wounded, and the Confederates under Robert E. Lee, about 30 to 35,000. It wasn't a good time in the war, not that there was any good time in the war, but war weariness actually was very palpable in the North, and even U.S. Grant, unconditional surrender, let's go, rested after Cold Harbor. But he also had in his place his grand plan to end the war, which was to surround Lee in Richmond and Petersburg and to choke him out and fight what Grant knew would be the ultimate winning battle. Now, this strategy worked, as you know. It worked in April of 1865. But we're now back in June. Remember, June 13th, 1864, where my story starts. So what does Robert E. Lee do? Lee knew what Grant was up to. I mean, Lee also knew that Grant would prevail if he didn't do something, because you know why. I mean, the North had large superiority in men, arms, munitions, supplies, everything. And Lee's supplies were dwindling, and he was surrounded. He knew what Grant was up to. So what did Robert E. Lee do? Well, he devised a bold four-part plan that he put into motion on June 13th. He took an entire corps of troops, about 12,000 men, a third of his force, and he sent them on his four-part mission. Part one was to kick the Yankees out of the Shenandoah Valley. Supply was big problem at this point. Most of the food in Richmond came from the valley. The valley was held by the North, and Lee wanted those railroad lines open and the food coming into Richmond, number one. Number two was to, quote, unquote, threaten Washington, D.C. Number three was to free about 14,000 Confederate prisoners who were being held at the Point Lookout POW camp. That was in Maryland. If you know southern Maryland, if you picture southern Maryland, the skinny peninsula, at the very bottom is Point Lookout. It's still there, Point Lookout. So this was not very far as the crow flies from Washington. On the other hand, it was down at the bottom of the southern Maryland peninsula. And the fourth part of the plan, and the plan that was uppermost in Robert E. Lee's mind, was to try to force Grant to send troops away from Richmond and Petersburg, because he knew what Grant was up to. So, at 3 o'clock in the morning, on June 13th, 1864, 12,000 troops snuck through the Union lines and left Richmond. Who did Lee put in charge of these troops? This man here, Jubal Early. Jubal Anderson Early. Does everybody know about Jubal Early? I'll tell you a little bit about him, because he is a real character. He's one of the two main characters in this book, and he was a character. He is a Virginian, He was born in Rocky Mount, Virginia, in Franklin County, which is near down south of Roanoke. He came from a prominent family there, and they sent him to West Point, not to be a military man, but to get the good education that West Point offered, which they still do. I mean, a lot of people would send their children to West Point. He graduated from West Point, and he went and he served briefly in the Seminole Wars in Florida, but he did not see any action. He went back to Rocky Mount, read the law, became a prominent lawyer, was a member of the Virginia House of Delegates for one term, and he got called up during the Mexican War. But by the time Early got to Mexico, the fighting was over. So he, even though he was in the Seminole Wars and the Mexican War, when the Civil War started, he had no battlefield experience. And in fact, he was a member of the Virginia Secession Convention, and he actually voted against secession. But when the tide turned and it was obvious that Virginia was going to secede, early voted for secession and then became one of the most, maybe the most gung-ho, dedicated Confederates from that moment until the day he died. He was dedicated to the cause. He was dedicated to Virginia. He was dedicated to Robert E. Lee. He got a regiment. He fought with distinction at First Manassas and went right up in the ranks and was a lieutenant general by this time. He was a very aggressive general, and I think I just enumerated all of Jubal Early's good points. His bad points, or I'll let you judge. I mean, he was hard drinking, tobacco chewing, hard cussing. He was famous for his cussing and his raspy voice. He was mean and cantankerous. He hated women. He was viciously racist. And I could go on. Well, you know, I did a talk down at Rocky Mount at the library there. My wife came with. She said, don't say anything bad about Jubal Early. I said, how can you not say anything bad about Jubal Early? She said, well, somebody might be there who's related to him. So I was talking to the librarian. I said, is it okay if... Yeah, they want to hear that stuff, you know. So, but I'm not making it up. Just you read. Even he did not get along with the men. The men sort of loved him and hated him. He was a taskmaster. He didn't get along with his fellow generals. But oddly enough, Robert E. Lee liked Jubal Early. He called him my bad old man. Even though Lee was older than Early. Early had when he went out to Mexico, he got rheumatoid arthritis, and he was a big guy, but he had the wild hair and the wild beard. He wore the slouch hat and the big coat, and he was hunched over, my bad old man. And you know, it's interesting that when you compare personalities, Robert E. Lee and Jubal Early, we got a 180 going here. I mean, Lee was a gentle man and a gentleman. Robert E. Lee, who said famously, it is good that war is so terrible, otherwise men would love it. And Jubal Early, who couldn't get enough of war, you know. But Lee chose Early for this mission. One reason also was that he really didn't have much choice. There weren't many other corps commanders left at this point. So he sends Early out with 12,000 troops on June 13th. They march 70 miles to a town called Charlottesville, Virginia. Okay, right here. And they get on rickety old trains, and they chug, 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 and they get to Lynchburg on June 17th. The next day, June 18th, is the Battle of Lynchburg. Does not roll off the tongue. We don't know much about why not? Because there wasn't much of a battle, because the Union general who was in charge down there, David Hunter, who was one of the dim bulbs in the Union filament, David Hunter fled as soon as realized he was facing Jubal Early, and Early had 12,000 troops. So Hunter fled down to Roanoke. He went over the mountains into what is now West Virginia. Now, Early actually started to chase him and then said, well, we're not going to chase him. Because remember, that was goal number one, kick the Yankees out of the valley. Goal number two was to threaten Washington, D.C. So what did he do? He made a forced march down, meaning north, down the Shenandoah Valley. 120 miles, clear shot, right up to Maryland, right up into Yankee land. It was extremely hot that summer. The Confederate troops were severely undersupplied. About a third of them didn't have shoes. They tied burlap bags around their feet. They got up to Stanton. They went through Lexington, where they paid their respects to Stonewall Jackson's grave, and they went to they got to Stanton, and they rested for 2 days while a shipment of supplies, including shoes, came by train from Richmond. Then they kept marching down the valley, and they got to the big Union storehouses in Harper's Ferry and Martinsburg, both of which were in Virginia then but are now West Virginia, on July 4th. The Union general there, Franz Sigel, fled. Franz Sigel, do you know about him? He's an interesting guy. He was German. He was a political general. He was appointed... He was from St. Louis. Lincoln wanted to get more German Americans and German immigrants in the Union Army. He wasn't a very good general. He was the general who presided at the Battle of Newmarket, May 15th, May 14th or 15th in 64. Remember that one at New Market when he outnumbered the Confederates? They were forced to have the entire corps of VMI cadets march 70 miles up to New Market from Lexington, kids as young as 15 years old, and they routed the Yankees. Siegel, whose nickname was the Flying Dutchman, for his propensity to leave the battlefield, fled again when Early's troops got up to Martinsburg and Harper's Ferry, and the Confederate troops were very happy to eat all the Yankees' food and drink all of their beverages that night. They had a nice 4th of July party. The next day, July 5th, 1864, they crossed the Potomac River at what is now Shepherdstown, West Virginia. They left Richmond on June 13th. They crossed the Potomac on July 5th. Early picked up 2,000 cavalry along the way. So now he has 14,000 troops. Some people call this a raid. This was not a raid. This was 14,000 ready-to-go Confederate troops. A lot of those boys were from Virginia and North Carolina. A lot of them were from Stonewall's brigade. They were in their home territory in the valley. And they were itching to do some trouble. There was a third invasion of the North, but the one you never hear about. Everybody hears about Antietam in 1862 and, of course, Gettysburg in 1863. Well, on July 5th, 1864, Jubal Early took a corps of 14,000 Confederate troops and crossed the Potomac into the Union territory. Siegel fled up. Everybody been to Harper's Ferry? You know those hills, those mountains on the Maryland side called the Maryland Heights. That's where Siegel went. And Early again thought about going after Siegel, but he had the high ground. It wasn't good strategically. And he was now 50 miles from Washington, D.C. And his orders were to threaten Washington. So they made a right turn. They headed down and they camped for 2 days outside of Sharpsburg near Antietam. This is when they got the order to do the POW raid. And you know how the order came? By horseback from Rob Lee. Robert E. Lee sent his son, Robert E. Lee Jr., with a pouch that he didn't even know what was in it. They didn't trust it to go over the wire. And this is where Early got the order to do the POW camp raid. So they rested for 2 days, and then they headed towards Washington, D.C. Now, part of Early's job also was he was on his own as far as living off the land. So he was going to the towns in Maryland and basically saying, we're going to burn your town down if we don't give you money, if you don't give us money and materiel, and which he did. And he stopped in Frederick, Maryland, which is now, what, 35, 40 miles from Washington, and demanded $200,000 in cash from the city fathers or he would cause trouble. Now, I think you might know that Union intelligence was not good during the Civil War. And it was true in this case, too, because the Union intelligence did not report that an entire corps of troops had left Richmond and Petersburg until they crossed the Potomac on July 5th. Did not know it. And then, of course, they got it all wrong. The first reports had it under General Ewell, and General Ewell was banged up and in the hospital and out of commission. It was Early. And then the first reports were 20,000, 35,000 troops. So the telegrams start going back and forth. Now, President Lincoln was not a commander-in-chief who gave specific orders to his commanders, including Grant. But you can read the telegrams. They're in the official records of the Civil War. General Grant. Now, Grant was not dumb either. Grant knew what Lee was doing. He soon realized that he was going to try. He was using this to try to force him to take troops away from Richmond and Petersburg, and his staff officers were urging him to do it, and Grant did not take any action. Now, one Union general did take action, and he did it on his own, and he's the other interesting character in my story, and that is this man, Lew Wallace. Lew Wallace, who did have one of the best goatees of any Union general, I would say. I'm jealous of that goatee. Do we know who Lew Wallace is? Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit about him because he had a very interesting life before, during, and after the Civil War. He was from a small town in Indiana called Crawfordsville, but he was, like Early, he was from a prominent family. A grandfather was a governor. I think a father was a governor. His father was a governor. He did see action in the Mexican War when he was a young man, 19 years old. But he really wasn't a military man. He didn't. He was sort of an aimless fellow when the war started. But he did raise a regiment, the 11th Indiana, and they went on. They had an early victory at Romney, West Virginia, in the summer of 61. This was soon after First Manassas, this humiliating Union defeat, and the Yankee press was looking for heroes. So they played him up big. Lew Wallace, hero of Battle of Romney. That went over well in Washington. He got promoted to general, and at that point he was the youngest general in the Union Army. Then he went on to do some pretty good things at the battles of Fort Henry and Donelson in Tennessee. That was his high point. His low point came at the Battle of Shiloh, when he got his regiment lost. There was a two-night battle the first night. Probably not his fault. Fog of war, bad weather, didn't know where he was. They did fight the second night, but remember, Grant was in charge at Shiloh, as was Halleck, who now, in 64, is now the Army Chief of Staff. And they were royally angry at him. And they didn't relieve him of his command, but they did push him to the side. He even was out of the Army for a while, went back to Indiana. But he was back in the Army now, and at this point, he was the commander of the Middle Atlantic Department. He was basically the military governor of Baltimore. Now, Maryland, you know, Maryland was a border state. They had slavery in southern Maryland. It was an iffy state. I mean, the Maryland legislature never did vote to stay with the Union. In the summer of 61, I tell this story in the book, they met, but the governor decided not to have the decisive meeting in Annapolis, the state capital, because it was too close to the slaveholding part. So they moved it to Frederick, Maryland. They never did vote on it. They took a summer recess, and when they came back, there were Union troops there. So Maryland was iffy the whole war. In fact, when Early's corps crossed the Potomac, there were bands playing Maryland, My Maryland, which, you know, that was written then, and it's really a pro-slavery song. They still haven't changed it. I think there's something in the Maryland legislature right now to change it. Anyway, even though there was secessionist sentiment in Maryland, it really wasn't a really great job. I mean, Wallace was itching to get back into the war. So he's reading the telegrams that Grant and Lincoln and Halleck are reading, and he takes action. The other twist to that is that John Garrett, who was the president of the B&O Railroad, was in Baltimore. And, you know, the railroad had better information than the Union spies because they had station masters all along those tracks, all along this whole area where Early was. And Garrett, who was looking out for his self-interest, I mean, he wanted his railroad to keep running, he was prodding Wallace to do something. So Wallace gathered up all the men he could, and believe me, he didn't have very many men. He got 2,800 men, and these men were all 100 days men. And the 100 days men were guys who signed up for 100 days, and then they would go home. These were all raw recruits, mostly from Ohio and Illinois, who had never fired a shot in anger. And Wallace takes them with him, and they go down to the westernmost point of the Middle Atlantic district, which was the east bank of the Monocacy River, which is 4 miles south of Frederick, Maryland. Frederick, Maryland was a strategic point in the war, throughout the war, although there were no battles were fought there. But in the earlier movements, well, Antietam, remember the story of Barbara Fritchie? That happened in Frederick because the Southern troops were, it's not true, of course, but I mentioned that in my flag book, yeah, the book I wrote about the American flag. It's a great story. But that happened or didn't happen as the Confederate troops were on the way to Antietam. And then at Gettysburg, the troops were going back and forth. It's a north, south, and east-west crossroads. You have the Georgetown Pike, Route 355, which is still there, which goes straight to Washington. And you have the National Pike, the old National Pike, Route 40, which goes straight to Baltimore. And then you had the railroad line coming down from Baltimore. So a lot of stuff happened there. And that's where Wallace set up his 2,800 men. Now, this is a gutsy thing for two reasons. Number one, he's still in hot water with his commanding officer, U.S. Grant, and the chief of staff, Halleck. I mean, they were looking for any excuse to wring his neck. And he thought he was going to be facing as many as 35,000 Southern troops. It was a gutsy thing. Now, he did ask for help. And finally, at the last minute, Grant acceded. And he sent two brigades of the 6th Corps, some of his most veteran fighters, from mostly from Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Vermont. And they were down around Richmond. They woke him up in the middle of the night. They marched up to City Point, which is Hopewell. They got on steamships. They went down the James. They went out up to the Chesapeake Bay, and they landed at the Baltimore Harbor. They marched to the train station at Camden Street, which is where the baseball stadium is now. And they got on trains, and they arrived at the Monocacy Junction at 1 o'clock in the morning on July 9th, 1864. The battle began at 8 a.m. Now Wallace had about 6,800 troops, including these veteran 6th Corps fighters. And he arrayed them up and down about 2 miles, actually on both sides of the river, but mostly they had the high ground. He had the strategic advantage. Now, Juba Early did not want to fight a battle at Monocacy. His orders were to threaten Washington, D.C. He's only 40 miles away. In fact, Early, as I said, was not even on the battlefield when the battle began. He was in the city of Frederick extorting $200,000 from the city fathers, which he did. And he didn't. The battle lasted the entire day, from 8 in the morning to about 4:30 in the afternoon. Early did come on the field of battle. He did not deploy all of his troops, but there were parts of that battle that were full field battles fought in corn and wheat fields on both sides of the river. When the smoke cleared, and the Confederates had overwhelming superiority in everything, including guns. They had, I don't know, 6 batteries of guns. The Union troops had 4 guns. And by the end of the day, of course, Early prevailed. There were about 1,300 Union casualties, killed, wounded, and taken prisoner, and about 800 Confederates. That's 2,100 casualties. This was not, some people call this a skirmish. This was not a skirmish. I mean, it was in Antietam, 22,000 casualties. But 2,100 is nothing to sneeze at. John Brown Gordon, who was one of Early's commanders, who was in the whole Wilderness campaign, earlier he had been shot 5 times at Antietam, the 5th time through his cheek that finally knocked him off his horse and out of the war for a while. Gordon said it was the sharpest fight he was in. And it was bloody, especially along those corn and wheat fields, which were, this was July, there were big stacks of wheat, there were cross fences. The Confederate troops got torn up pretty badly, as did the Union troops. The river ran red with blood, someone said, who was there. Of course, Early did prevail. And that night, he rested his men on the battlefield. Uncharacteristic for Early, but you have to remember, it was July. Everybody who wrote about this battle commented about how hot it was. I mean, some of them said they'd never felt heat like this. And no one ever wrote down a temperature, but we know what it had to be in the mid to upper 90s and humid. And the Confederate troops had been on the march, you know, since June 13th. It's now July 9th, going into July 10th. So he rested them on the field of battle. The next morning, July 10th, they started towards Washington. He did send 2,000 troops, cavalry, north towards Baltimore for 2 reasons. One, as a feint, so he would not, so the Yankees wouldn't quite know what he was doing. And 2, to cut the railroad line and the telegraph line, which they did. Washington is now cut off from the outside world. The rebels are at the gates, Gideon Welles, Navy Secretary, wrote in his diary. Panic is starting to come in the streets of Washington. And I'll tell you why. Let's just go back a little bit and think about where Washington is geographically. It's across the river from Virginia. It's 90 miles from Richmond. You know, when the war first started, when Virginia seceded, you could see Confederate flags from the high points of Washington over the river into Virginia. From the very beginning of the war, they were concerned about an invasion of Washington, and why not? Especially after First Manassas, this disastrous Union defeat 35 miles from the Capitol Dome. So what happened was, in the summer of 61, the Union decided to build a series of forts and fortifications to surround Washington. And by this time, by the summer of 64, they were finished. There were 67 forts built like a beltway around Washington, and of course into Virginia, because the Yankees took Alexandria in May of 61, and you know, northern part of Arlington and Great Falls and all that area. They stretched into Virginia. The forts were all connected by a series of berms and embankments, and the forts were built well. Now, they weren't huge forts. They were open on the back. They were defensive forts, and they had a lot of cannon, especially at the bigger forts. Now, the defenses of Washington were designed to be manned by about 35,000 men. But at this point in the war, nearly all the able-bodied Union troops were down outside Richmond and Petersburg. Now, we don't know the exact number, but the best guess is there were about 10, 11,000 troops manning Washington and defenses designed for 35,000. And who were these troops? Well, most of them were members of what was known as the Veteran Reserve Corps. Now, the Veteran Reserve Corps had changed its name just before this. You know what it was called before? The Invalid Corps. You know why they changed their name. They were embarrassed to be, you know, there were so many casualties, and Washington was like a giant hospital at this point, that when the guys got better but couldn't go back to the field, they gave them these pale blue uniforms, called them members of the Invalid Corps, and they gave them rear echelon duty. That's who was defending Washington when the telegraph line is cut, and they think 40,000 Confederate troops are now 30 miles away and marching there on a beeline. So you can imagine, the telegrams are going back and forth to City Point, and again, Grant hesitates. He does not want to send troops. He knows what Lee is up to here. So the call goes out in Washington for every able-bodied man to man the barricades. So you had Quartermaster Corps people who never fired weapons. You had civilians, clerks from the State Department, going out to defend the city. The word motley has been used by more than one person to describe who was defending Washington with, you know, 12,000 lean and hungry Confederate troops on the march. So on July 10th, they got as far as Rockville and Gaithersburg. They came down Route 355, which is still there. Back then, it was called the Georgetown Pike. Now it's called Urbana Pike, because there's a little town called Urbana, Maryland. And then it's called the Rockville Pike, and then it becomes Georgetown Pike. So now Rockville, I think you probably know, is a big suburb of Washington now. Back then, it was Nowheresville. It was considered pretty far away from town. Although the Union did send out some skirmishers and some pickets, and there was skirmishing in Rockville, not very much. Early, of course, was busy extorting money from the city fathers and materiel. And the next day, July 12th, 1864, Jubal Early, who was one of those generals who was on the horse out there in front of the men, arrived outside Fort Stevens in Washington at the head of his men. If you think of Washington, D.C. as shaped like a diamond, Fort Stevens is near the very tip of the diamond in upper northwest, near Walter Reed Army Medical Center, about a mile from the Silver Spring line. Early is sitting on his horse outside Fort Stevens. In his glass, he can see the Capitol Dome. The South's most aggressive general has the Capitol Dome in his sights. And what did he do? He did not attack. And he defended that decision for the rest of his life. He gave two primary reasons later for not attacking. One was he looked at this fort, Fort Stevens, which was the main fort in the northern part of the city. The 7th Street Pike, which is now Georgia Avenue, was the main northern entry into the city. And this was right off Georgia, or 7th Street Pike. He said that he looked at this fort and it looked impregnable. And it did look impregnable. There were big guns there. And he saw troops on the parapets and back there. He didn't know they were invalids, but he saw them. And secondly, he said they had just had the sharp fight at Monocacy. He said he was down to about 8,000 able-bodied troops because of the wounded and the ones who were killed and the ones who were taking care of the Yankee prisoners. Plus, they were strung out all along the Georgetown Pike way back to Rockville and Gaithersburg. So he did not feel as though he could attack. Now, the artillery got up there, and Jubal Early being Jubal Early, there was fighting. There was skirmishing. And there was artillery duels going back and forth. And, you know, the citizens from Washington came up there to see what the hubbub was about, kind of like at First Manassas, which you read about. And when I say from Washington, even though Fort Stevens was in the boundaries of Washington, D.C., it was farmland back then. It really wasn't considered Washington. What was considered Washington was downtown, the capital, Georgetown, even Alexandria. That's where Washington City was. But up there was, they didn't have the word suburbs, but it was like beyond the suburbs. So the citizens came out, including President Lincoln. And there was President Lincoln, all 6 feet, four of them, in the stovepipe hat, standing on the parapet at Fort Stevens, and a Union surgeon named Crawford, standing next to him, was shot and wounded by a Confederate sharpshooter who was in the trees, probably in what is now Walter Reed Army Medical Center. There's a plaque at a tree. It's probably that tree, maybe. But anyway, just to give you an idea of the geography of it. At which point, Lincoln was kindly asked to get down from the parapet. This marked the only time in American history that a sitting U.S. president came under fire in a war. July 11th, 1864, Fort Stevens, Abraham Lincoln. There's going to be a quiz. So, finally, Grant gives in, and he sends the rest of the 6th Corps up to Washington, as well as the 19th Corps. The 19th Corps was in New Orleans. They were coming up on trains. They were going to stop. They were going to be part of the siege at Richmond and Petersburg, but they didn't even get off the trains. They came up straight up to Washington. Again, the rest of the 6th Corps, they marched up to City Point. They went down the James. This time they went up the Potomac. They went by Mount Vernon. And several of the guys wrote in their journals and their diaries and their memoirs later about what that feeling was like to drive by Mount Vernon and see George Washington's house and go up and get ready to fight other Americans. It was kind of a moving moment. They got to the docks. There used to be docks down at 6th and 7th Street, the old wharfs in Washington. The citizens from Washington were out there to greet them, including President Lincoln, with sandwiches and ice water, and we've been saved. The 6th Corps is here. So they marched up 7th Street, Georgia Avenue, and they arrived at Fort Stevens about the time that Early had the Capitol Dome in his sights, or a little bit after, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He was there about noon. They weren't deployed right away, but they were deployed, and they took part in the skirmishing that went back and forth. Went into the night. That night, Early took his generals for a council of war back into Silver Spring, and they commandeered a mansion. It was the Silver Spring Mansion, owned by the Blair family. Francis Preston Blair was a prominent Republican. He was actually one of the founders of the Republican Party way back when, after Andy Jackson time. And he was a friend of Lincoln's. His son, Montgomery Blair, was the Postmaster General. Well, the Blair family decided to go fishing in Pennsylvania, left the house, and Early and his generals. Now, his generals were John Brown Gordon of Georgia, two Virginia generals, Stephen Dotson Ramsey and Robert Emmett Rhodes, and John C. Breckinridge of Kentucky, former Vice President of the United States. Well, John C. Breckinridge knew the Blairs when he was Vice President. More importantly, he knew where the wine cellar was. So that night, Early didn't have to be asked twice. They raided Blair's wine cellar, ate up their food, and decided the next morning, July 12th, they would make a decision whether or not to invade Washington. So, and I'm only going to say this once, so that next morning, Early got up bright and early. No more of that. And again, led the troops out, got in front of Fort Stevens. Now, this time he saw the place was crawling with troops. And the 6th Corps had this Greek cross, a white cross on their sleeve. He knew right away that he was not going to invade. He didn't want to go toe-to-toe with the 6th Corps in Washington. So, but being Jubal Early, the aggressive commander, the artillery was booming back and forth, and there was skirmishing back and forth. Do you know there were 300 Union troops killed or wounded in those 2 days of fighting inside Washington, D.C.? I mean, this is a fact that never really has percolated up there. We don't know how many Confederate troops casualties there were. It never made the official record. It had to be that many or more. These guys were tired. I mean, these guys had been on the march. You know, it's now a month. and it was hot. They just fought this battle at Monocacy. Anyway, they fought that night. The next morning on July 13th, when the Yankees woke up and looked out, Early's men were gone. In the middle of the night, they had retraced their steps. They went back into Silver Spring, down in Montgomery County, Maryland, down to Poolsville, and they crossed the Potomac River at White's Ferry on July 13th. Anybody been to White's Ferry? There's a ferry boat there. What's the name of it? The Jubal Early. Now you know why. Now you know why. And by the way, remember what I said when I started? July 13th, 1864? That's when Early came back into Leesburg, and that's basically all I know about the Civil War. Let me just, except for this, I know a little bit more, but the subtitle of the book is How a Little-Known Civil War Battle Saved Washington, D.C. and Changed American History. Did the Battle of Monocacy save Washington, D.C.? I think it did. I really do. When U.S. Grant and Henry Old Brains Halleck found out that Wallace was defeated at Monocacy, they relieved Wallace of his command. They were angry. This was the end for Lew Wallace. But 2 weeks later, they realized what he did. Taking, you know, facing off with 2,800 men, what he thought was going to be 30,000, and holding up Early for a day. 2 weeks later, they reinstated him. And U.S. Grant writes in his memoir that had Wallace not done what he did, had he not held Early up an entire day, probably two, because remember they rested the next day on the battlefield, that Grant said he would not have been able to get troops up to Washington in time. So I think we can say he would not have been able to get troops up in Washington before Early did. So Early would have been whatever. So I think we can say that it did save Washington. Now, save Washington from what? That's an open question. It's a what if. Historians don't like what ifs. But think about some of the what ifs. There was the U.S. Treasury to be looted. If you had 8,000-10,000 lean and mean and hungry Confederate troops loose in the streets of Washington, the Treasury to be looted, there was tons of material and supplies. Congress, the Capitol could have been burned. The White House could have been burned. You know, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy provisioned a ship in the Potomac so that they could get Lincoln out of town if the Confederates breached the city gates. Lincoln did not know about it at the time, and when he found out, he was not happy about it. But nevertheless, think about this. You know, they didn't have CNN back then, I'm told. But they did have newspapers covered the hell out of that war. You know that. And think of the headlines. You know, Confederate troops inside Washington, Lincoln flees. The ramifications, two ramifications that come to mind right away. Number one, England and France. England and France were itching to get in on this war on behalf of the Confederates. They never did. I mean, for, you know, economic purposes only. I'm not making this up. This was talked about at the time, that they very possibly could have, that could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Secondly, you know, one thing we tend to forget is that 1864 was a presidential election year. The United States, this great country of ours, is the only country that's ever held a Democratic presidential election during a full-blown Civil War. And that's what happened in 1864. Lincoln's popularity was lower than, well, they didn't have Gallup polls back then, but I bet it was below 29%. It was lower than any president, or as low as any president. The Republican Party was divided. You know, the peace Republicans wanted to sue for peace. The radical Republicans the peace Republicans said Lincoln wasn't doing enough for peace, and the radical Republicans said he wasn't doing enough for war. The Democrats were divided among themselves, but united against Lincoln. Lincoln almost didn't get the Republican nomination. He barely got it. And then what? He had to choose a Democrat as his running mate. He didn't have to, but I mean, he chose a Southern Democrat as his running mate, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee. He knew, the country knew, that it was unlikely that he was going to get reelected. He wrote a famous memo to his cabinet, sealed, said, open it up after the election. When they opened it up, it said, in other words, please cooperate with the new administration in a smooth transition. So with Lincoln's popularity in the toilet, what would a Southern invasion of Washington have done? Of course, again, it's another what if. You can't prove it, but it's one of those what ifs that came pretty darn close to happening. And the last thing I'll say, as far as changing history, what I'm talking about here is not just the Battle of Monocacy, but Lee's four-part plan. Remember, part one, kick the Yankees out of the valley. Done. Part two, threaten Washington, D.C. And Early was given the choice to go in or not, his choice. Done. Now, the POW raid was not attempted. It was called off unclear reasons, probably having to do with the fact that there would have had to been a naval component, and the South just couldn't get it together in that. But the fourth part of the plan, and the plan that was uppermost in Lee's mind, was a success. Just go by the numbers. Here's the numbers. On June 30th, there were 137,454 Union troops surrounding Richmond and Petersburg. 137,000. On August 31st, there were 69,206. 137,000 versus 69. Now, not all of these went up north. Most of them, a big number did. Some enlistments were up and they went home. Nevertheless, you had half as many troops there after this whole business that Lee concocted. So that did work. And Grant's grand plan to end the war did work, but it didn't work until April of 1865. We're now in July of 64. If, and here's another what if, you can't prove it, but if Lee hadn't done this, if all those Union troops stayed there, I believe, my educated guess is, that the war could have ended 3 months sooner, 6 months sooner, 5 months sooner, who knows? It's another what if, but it's one that you can ponder. And it also goes to show you that nothing is inevitable in history. This war, any war, whatever, did not have to end the way it did, and it did only because of a series of big and small turning points invade, not invade, do this, do that. Anyway, that was my contention. So that's sort of it in a nutshell. And before I go to question time, I just would like you, if you take one thing away from what I've been speaking about, I'd like you to remember that Jubal Early was one day late. Early was late. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Right. Well, the question is, what about Sherman and Grant, who are these aggressive generals who are going to go, no matter what happened? Now, that didn't happen until September 1st, right? Yeah. So, and by the way, that's after July 13th, so. But, no, you're absolutely right. And I didn't tell the whole story. I mean, Lincoln's popularity did a 180 when Sherman took Atlanta, and Sheridan, don't forget Phil Sheridan, started winning in the Valley. Nevertheless, you look at the election results in 1864. It was no landslide. And the Democratic candidate, George McClellan, was not setting the world on fire either. The Republicans had to do a few things, like for the first time they allowed troops to go home and vote, and they gave them liberal leave to do so. It was not a landslide. And of course, you're right. I mean, these are all what ifs, and they're unprovable in either direction. Yes, sir. Question is: do I believe that? Some people say that Early was a good division commander, but not a good corps commander. See, most of that stuff happened before June 13th, 1864. I mean, we were talking about the tactics at Monocacy, and if you go up to Monocacy and you try to envision, it's a difficult battle to envision because lots of different things were happening at the same time in different places. And you're right, the division commanders were on. It was Gordon who bailed out McCausland. McCausland, Tiger John McCausland, was a cavalry commander who made a dreadful mistake at Monocacy and did a dismounted cavalry charge. And he got torn up in those wheat and cornfields I was telling you, because the Union troops under Ricketts were waiting for him and just tore him up.
Well, actually, Ricketts is out of Sixth
Corps. Right. Right. Did everybody get that? I mean, some of the prisoners that he took, that the Southerners took at Monocacy, were Sixth Corps men. which led Early to believe that when he got to Washington, that those guys he saw who were the Invalid Corps guys were Sixth Corps. So that would be another argument in his favor for not going in. Right. Young man in the back. I would encourage people to go to see the Monocacy Battlefield because, as Rick said, there's a new... Well, the visitor center... They had an inadequate visitor center, and they built a new one. It opened in the summer of 07, and it's terrific. They have a museum-quality exhibit. Plus, like I said, it's a hard battlefield to envision, but where they had the visitor center, it's at the northern edge of the battlefield, and they have a second story. So you get up there, and you can get a very good idea of what was going on. Now, Route 355, which I mentioned then and now, goes through the battlefield. However, Interstate 270 did not back then. And Interstate 270 goes through that entire battlefield, which is a damn shame. So in order to see it, you have to drive to at least three different points, including going underneath the... Yeah, but it's definitely worth seeing. Yes, sir. No, how did Early get 14,000 troops across the Potomac? They marched across a shallow part, and the rocks tore up those guys' shoes. The guys who didn't have shoes tore up their feet. They must have had them on wagons and stuff, the artillery. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Why did England and France want to join... For economic reasons, because of the embargo, because of the we couldn't get, the Yankees had the coast blocked and couldn't get any good, well, they had blockade runners, but the blockade really crimped England and France trade with the South. Cotton. Tobacco. Money. I found contemporary sources. The question is, England really would not support the South because of slavery after the Emancipation Proclamation. But there are contemporary sources that I quote in the book that did speak of this as a possibility. Yeah. Lew Wallace, now everybody knows what happened to Lew Wallace after the war, right? He had this amazing career. He was territorial governor of New Mexico. He was ambassador to Turkey. And then he decided to become a novelist. And he wrote the second best-selling novel of the 19th century, Ben-Hur. Now, he also wrote an 800-page autobiography. Ask me if I read that. I read every word dealing with the Battle of Monocacy. And it was actually a lot of fun because, you know, you're reading all these dry records and other memoirs. And Lew Wallace wrote his autobiography like a florid 19th century novel. So he didn't say, you know, when we got to the Monocacy Junction, we lit our campfires and we made our coffee. You know, he said, you know, as the North Star twinkled above the Catoctin Mountains, the smoke from our fire went, you know. So that was kind of fun. And of course, Lew Wallace made himself out to be the hero of Monocacy. He claimed in his autobiography that he knew that he was keeping Early from invading. And so it would be like, you know, 9:30, our heroic men dug in and repulsed the attack. One more hour that we kept Washington out of the hands of 10:30. You know, there was more by the bridge. Another hour goes by and our precious nation's capital is saved. So, but the good thing about that is that you can compare what he wrote, you know, that was the last book he wrote, with what he wrote. Well, you know, he sent telegrams from the field of battle. Then he wrote the first after-action report the next day, and then he spiffed that one up about 2 weeks later. So it's all in the official records. So you get a pretty clear picture, but it's a lot of fun to read Lew Wallace. Yes? The question is, when did the Sixth Corps get there as far as when Early was? At about noontime, Early arrived the first day on July 11th. That's when he had the Capitol Dome in his sights. The Sixth Corps was getting off the ships at that time down at the bank in Washington. So the guys he saw then were the Invalid Corps guys. But he didn't know that because of he'd seen the Sixth Corps guys at Monocacy and because he just saw troops there. So the next day he saw that they were the Sixth Corps guys on the 12th. Oh, yeah, Early's life after the war. Yeah. Lynchburg. He didn't sign the oath. He was hardcore to the end. He went out west because he thought that the Confederates were going to continue the battle. When that didn't happen, he went into exile in Mexico. He didn't like it there, so he went to Canada. He did write his first memoir there in 66, the first memoir by a significant participant in the war. And then somehow, I'm not quite certain how, he came back here. He spent the rest of his life living in a hotel room in Lynchburg. Well, he did. He never married. That's right. Yes, he did. And he recognized them, and they have the name Early. I know that. Well, I was talking about after. Early's military disastrous after Monocacy. He won third Winchester, and then came Cedar Creek, and the whole thing fell apart, and Lee relieved him of his command. Nevertheless, he was so loyal to Robert E. Lee. He was, well, what he did for the rest of his life, he got a putative job. Somebody supported him. And he, he was one of the originators of the Lost Cause theory. And he proselytized that and burnished the legend of Robert E. Lee and gave speeches, wrote a second memoir. He wrote letters to the editor. He was out there on the stump. And defended his decision not to go into Monocacy to his dying day, right? Yes, sir. So there's criticism of Wallace for not anticipating or for anticipating what Early would do wrong. I'm not, tactics are not my strong suit, but I mean, just coming into this, I think it was a miracle that he held out all day from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon. Over 14,000 versus 6,800. Although Early did not employ all of his troops, we know that. But Early was trying to win there, and Wallace was trying to defeat him, and he held him up for a day. So I'm giving it to Lew Wallace. Yeah. So one of Newt Gingrich's novels that imagines what would have happened has a battle at Monocacy between Grant and whoever. It doesn't matter. It's all made up. So, I did not read them. I mean, I had enough trouble reading the nonfiction, you know, so I didn't want to get bogged down in the fiction. So, well, listen, thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.